have to figure out how the twins are getting in and out. The next night, at the same late hour, I position myself in the training building itself, across from the pillar where I saw the masks disappear. The minutes pass. Half an hour, they don't appear. Eventually, I make myself leave. I can't risk missing a summons from the commandant. I feel like shouting in frustration. The Faraz might have disappeared into the secret entrance before I ever got to the building, or they might arrive there when I'm already in my bed. Whatever the case, I need more time to watch. "I'll go tomorrow," Izzy says when she meets me in my quarters as the final peals of 11th bell fade. "The commandant rang for water, asked where you were when I took it to her. I told her Cook sent you on a late-night errand, but that excuse won't work twice." I don't want to let Izzy help, but I know I won't succeed without her. Every time she leaves for the training building, my resolve to get her out of Blackcliff grows stronger. I will not leave her here when I go. I cannot. We alternate nights, risking all in the hopes that we'll spot the Faraz again. But maddeningly, we come up with nothing. "If all else fails," Izzy says the night before I'm to make my report, "you can ask Cook to teach you how to blow a hole in the outer wall. She used to make explosives for the resistance." "They want a secret entrance," I say. But I smile because the thought of a giant, smoking hole in Blackcliff's wall is a happy one. Izzy heads out to watch for the Faraz, and I wait for the commandant to summon me. But she doesn't, and instead I lay in my pallet, staring at the pitted stone of my roof, forcing myself not to imagine Darren suffering at the hands of the marshals, trying to figure out a way to explain my failure to Mazin. Then, just before 11th bell, Izzy burst into my room. "I found it, Lyra! The tunnel the Faraz have been using! I found it!"
Chapter 32. Elias. I start losing battles. It's Tristus's fault. He planted the seed of Helene being in love with me in my head, and now it's sprouted like a misbegotten weed from hell. At sim training, Zack comes at me with unusual sloppiness, but instead of obliterating him, I let him knock me on my ass because I've caught a glimpse of blonde across the field. What does that lurch in my stomach mean? When the hand-to-hand centurion screams at me for poor technique, I barely hear him. Instead, considering what will happen to Helen me. Is our friendship ruined? If I don't love her back, will she hate me? How am I supposed to get her on my side for the trials if I can't give her what she wants? So many bleeding, stupid questions. Do girls think like this all the time? No wonder they're so confusing. The third trial, the trial of strength, is in 2 days. I know I have to focus, to ready my mind and my body. I must win. But in addition to Helene, there's someone else crowding my thoughts. Lyra. I try for days not to think about her. In the end, I stop resisting. Life is hard enough without having to avoid entire rooms in my own head. I imagine the fall of her hair and the glow of her skin. I smile at how she laughed when we danced, with a freedom of spirit I found exhilarating in its possibility. I remember how her eyes closed when I spoke to her in Sadhis. But at night, when my fears crawl out of the dark places in my mind, I think of the dread on her face when she realized who I was. I think of her disgust when I tried to protect her from the commandant. She must hate me for subjecting her to something so demeaning, but it was the only way I could think of to keep her safe. So many times in the past week, I've nearly walked to her quarters to see how she is. but showing kindness to a slave will only bring the blackguard down on me. Lyra and Helene, they're so different. I like that Lyra says things I don't expect, that she speaks almost formally, as if she's telling a story. I like that she defied my mother to go to the Moon Festival, whereas Helene always obeys the Commandant. Lyra is the wild dance of a tribal campfire, while Helene is the cold blue of an alchemist's flame. But why am I even comparing them? I've known Lyra a few weeks and Helene all my life. Helene's no passing attraction. She's family. More than that, she's part of me. Yet she won't speak to me, won't look at me. The third trial is days away, and all I've gotten from her are glares and muttered insults. Which brings another worry to the forefront of my mind. I'd been counting on Helene winning the trials, naming me Bloodshrike, and then releasing me from my duty. I can't see her doing that if she loathes me, which means that if I win the next trial, and if she wins the final trial, she could force me to remain Bloodshrike against my will. And if that happens, I'll have to run. And then honor will demand that she have me hunted down and killed. On top of that, I've heard students whispering that the Emperor is days away from Serra and planning vengeance against the aspirants and anyone associated with them. The cadets and skulls pretend to shake off the rumors, but the yearlings aren't so skilled at hiding their fear. You'd think the Commandant would be taking precautionary measures against an attack on Blackcliff, but she seems unconcerned. Probably because she wants us all dead. Or me, anyway. You're screwed, Elias, a wry voice tells me. Just accept it. Should have run when you had the chance. My spectacular losing streak doesn't go unnoticed. My friends are worried about me, and Marcus makes a point of challenging me on the combat field every chance he gets. Grandfather sends a two-word note, inked with such force that the parchment is torn. Always victorious! All the while, Helene watches, growing more infuriated every time she beats me in combat or witnesses someone else beat me. She's itching to say something, but her stubbornness won't let her. Until, that is, she finds Dex and Tristus tailing her to the barracks 2 nights before the third trial. After interrogating them, she finds me.
What the hell is wrong with you, Vittorius?
She grabs my arm outside the Skull's barracks, where I was heading for a bit of rest before a graveyard shift on the wall.
You think I can't defend myself? You think I need bodyguards?
No, I just...
You're the one who needs protection. You're the one who's been losing every battle. Skies, a dead dog could best you in a fight. Why don't you just hand the Empire over to Marcus right now?
A group of yearlings watches us with interest, scurrying away only when Helene snarls at them. I've been distracted, I say, worrying about you.
You don't need to worry about me. I can take care of myself. And I don't need your henchmen following me. They're your friends, Helene. They're not going to stop being your friends just because you're mad at me. I don't need them. I don't need any of you. I didn't want Marcus to... Screw Marcus! I could beat Marcus to a pulp with my eyes closed. And I could beat you too. Tell them to leave me alone.
No. She gets in my face, anger radiating off her in waves.
Call them off.
Not gonna do it. She crosses her arms and stands inches from my face.
I challenge you. Single combat, 3 battles. You win, I keep the bodyguards. You lose, you call them off.
Fine, I say, knowing I can beat her. I've done it 1,000 times before. When?
Now. I want this done with.
She makes for the closest training building, and I take my time following, watching the way she moves. Angry, favoring her right leg, must have bruised the left in practice. Keeps clenching that right fist, probably because she wants to punch me with it. Rage colors her every movement. Rage that has nothing to do with her so-called bodyguards, and everything to do with me and her and the confusion rolling around inside both of us. This should be interesting. Eline heads for the largest of the empty training rooms, launching an attack the second I'm through the door. As I expected, she comes at me with a right hook, hissing when I duck it. She's fast and vengeful, and for a few minutes, I think my losing streak might continue. But an image of Marcus gloating, of Marcus ambushing Helene, sets my blood boiling, and I unleash a vicious offense. I win the first battle, but Helene rebounds in the second, nearly taking my head off with the swiftness of her attack. 20 minutes later, when I yield, she doesn't bother to relish the victory. "Again," she says. "Try and show up this time." We circle each other like wary cats until I fly toward her, my sim high. She is undaunted, and our weapons crash together in a starburst of sparks. Battle rage takes me. There is perfection in a fight like this. My sim is an extension of my body, moving so swiftly that it might be its own master. The battle is a dance, one I know so well I barely have to think. And though the sweat floods off me and my muscles burn, desperate for rest, I feel alive, obscenely alive. We match each other stroke for stroke until I get a hit on her right arm. She tries to switch sword arms, but I jab my sim at her wrist faster than she can parry. Her sim goes flying, and I tackle her. Her white blonde hair tumbles free of her bun. "Surrender!" I pin her down at the wrists, but she thrashes and rips one arm free, scrabbling for a dagger at her waist. Steel stabs at my ribs, and seconds later, I'm on my back with a blade at my throat. "Ha!" She leans down, her hair falling around us like a shimmering silver curtain. Her chest heaves. She's covered in sweat. Hurt darkens her eyes. And she is still so beautiful that my throat tightens, and I want so badly to kiss her. She must see it in my eyes, because the hurt turns to confusion as we gaze at each other. I know then that there is a choice to be made, a choice that might change everything. Kiss her, and she'll be yours. You can explain everything, and she'll understand, because she'll love you. She'll win the trials, you'll be Bloodshrike, and when you ask for freedom, she'll give it to you. But will she? If I'm entangled with her, won't that make it worse? Do I want to kiss her because I love her, or because I need something from her? Or both? All this passes through my head in a second.
"Do it!"
my instincts scream.
"Kiss her!"
I wrap her silk-smooth hair around my hand. Her breath catches, and she melts into me, her body suddenly, intoxicatingly pliant. And then, as I pull her face toward me, as our eyes are closing, we hear the scream.
Chapter 33. Liar. The school is mostly quiet when Izzy and I emerge from the slaves' quarters. A few students still out head to the barracks in small groups, their shoulders slumped with tiredness. "Did you see the Faraz go in?" I ask Izzy on the way to the training building. She shakes her head. "I was sitting there, staring at those pillars, bored as a stone, when I noticed one of the bricks was different. Shiny, like it had been touched more than the others. And then, well, come on, I'll show you." We enter the building and are greeted by the almost musical ring of clashing cymbals. Ahead of us, a training room door stands open, and gold torchlight pours into the hallway. A pair of masks battles within, each brandishing two slender Sims. It's Futurius, Izzy says. And Aquila. They've been at it for ages. As I watch them fight, I find that I'm holding my breath. They move like dancers, whirling back and forth across the room. Graceful, liquid, deadly. And so swift, like shadows on the surface of a river. If I wasn't watching it with my own eyes, I would never believe anyone could move that fast. Futurius knocks a Sim from Aquila's hand, and he is on her, their bodies entangled as they wrestle across the floor with a strange, intimate violence. He is all muscle and force, and yet I can see in the way he fights that he is holding himself back. He is refusing to unleash his whole strength on her. Even still, there is an animal freedom to how he moves, a controlled chaos that makes the air around him blaze, so different from Keenan, with his restrained solemnity and cool interest. Why are you comparing them anyway? I turn from the aspirants. Izzy, come on. The building seems empty, other than Futurius and Aquila. But Izzy and I edge along the walls carefully in case there's a student or centurion lurking. We turn the corner, and I recognize the doors the Farrars used when I saw them enter here the first time nearly a week ago. Here, liar. Izzy slips behind one of the pillars and raises her hand to a brick that, at first glance, looks like all the others. She taps it. With a quiet groan, a section of stone swings away into darkness. Lamplight illuminates a narrow descending staircase. I look down, barely daring to believe what I'm seeing. Then envelop Izzy in a grateful hug. Izzy, you did it! I don't understand why she's not smiling back until her face goes rigid and she grabs me. Shh, she says. Listen. The flat tones of a mask's voice echo from the tunnel, and the stairwell glows with approaching torchlight. Close it, Izzy says, quickly, before they see. I put my hand to the brick, tapping it frantically. Nothing happens.
Pretend you don't see it, but you do.
A vaguely familiar voice rises from the stairwell as I pour at the brick.
You've always known how I feel about her. Why do you torment her? Why do you hate her so much? She's an illustrian snob. She'd never have you anyway. Maybe if you'd left her alone, I'd have had a chance. She's our enemy, Zack. She's going to die. Get over it. Then why did you tell her that you two are meant to be? Why do I get the feeling that you want her to be your Bloodshrike instead of me? I'm messing with her head, you bleeding idiot. And apparently it's working so well that even you're affected.
I recognize the voices now. Marcus and Zack. Izzy pushes me aside and punches at the brick. The entrance remains stubbornly open. Forget it. Izzy says, come on. She grabs me, but Marcus's face emerges at the bottom of the stairwell, and spotting me, he bounds up, reaching me in two strides. Run, I shout at Izzy. Marcus grabs for Izzy, but I shove her out of the way, and his arm wraps around my neck instead, choking off my air. He wrenches my head back, and I stare into his pale yellow eyes.
What's this, spying wench? Trying to find a way to sneak out of the school?
Izzy stands unmoving in the hallway, right eye wide in terror. I can't let her get caught, not after all she's done for me. Go, Iz, I scream.
Run! Get her, you twit,
Marcus roars at his brother, who has just emerged from the tunnel. Zack makes a half-hearted effort to grab Izzy, but she wrenches out of his grasp and runs back the way we came.
Marcus, come on,
Zack sounds exhausted and looks longingly toward the heavy oak doors that lead outside.
Leave her be. We have to be up early. Don't you remember her, Zack?
Marcus says. I struggle and try to kick the soft place between his foot and ankle, but he yanks me off my feet.
She's the commandant's girl.
She's expecting me. I choke out.
She won't mind if you're late. Marcus smiles, a jackal's grin. I made you a promise that day outside her office, remember? I told you that one night you'd be alone in a dark hallway and I'd find you. I always keep my promises.
Zack groans.
Marcus, if you want to be such a eunuch, little brother, Marcus says, then piss off and leave me to my entertainment.
Zack regards his twin for a moment, then he sighs and walks away. No, come back.
Just you and me, beautiful, Marcus whispers in my ear.
I bite viciously at his arm and try to wriggle away, but he spins me around by my neck and shoves me against the pillar.
Shouldn't have fought, he says. I would have gone easy on you. But then I lack a little spirit in my women.
His fist comes whistling toward my face. An infinite, explosive moment later, my head hits the stone behind me with a sickening smack, and I'm seeing double. Fight back, liar. For Darin, for Izzy, for every scholar this beast has abused, fight! A scream bursts from me, and I claw at Marcus's face, but a punch to my stomach takes the wind out of my lungs. I double over, retching, and his knee comes up into my forehead. The hallway spins, and I drop to my knees. Then I hear him laughing, a sadistic chuckle that stokes my defiance. Sluggishly, I throw myself at his legs. It won't be like before, like during the raid, when I let that mask drag me about my own house like some dead thing. This time I'll fight, tooth and nail, I'll fight. Marcus grunts in surprise, losing his footing, and I untangle myself and try to scramble to my feet. But he catches my arm and backhands me. My head strikes the floor, and then he's kicking me until my flesh is minced. When I stop resisting, he straddles me and pins my arms down. I release one last scream, but it turns to a whimper as he lays a finger against my mouth. My eyes are closing, swelling shut. I can't see. I can't think. Far away, the bells of the clock tower toll 11.
Chapter 34. Elias. At the sound of the scream, I roll out from under Helene and onto my feet, the kiss forgotten. She falls unceremoniously to her back. The scream echoes again, and I snatch up my sim. A second later, she grabs hers and follows me into the hallway. Outside, the bell tower tolls 11. A blonde slave girl is running toward us. Izzy.
Help! She shouts. Please, Marcus is... he's...
I'm already running up the darkened corridor, Izzy and Helene behind me. We don't have to go far. As we turn a corner, we find Marcus hunched atop a prone form, his face stretched into a savage leer. I can't see who it is, but it's obvious what he's planning to do. He's not expecting company, which is why we're able to get him off the slave so quickly. I tackle him and rain down punches, growling in satisfaction at the snap of bone beneath my fist, reveling in the blood that sprays across the wall. As his head whips back, I stand and draw my sim, resting the point on his ribcage between the plates of his armor. Marcus scrambles to his feet, his arms in the air.
Are you going to kill me, Vittorius?
He asks, still grinning despite the blood dripping down his face.
With a training sim?
Might take longer. I drive it harder into his ribs. But it'll do the job.
You're on watch tonight, Snake, Helene says. What the hell are you doing in a dark hallway with a slave?
Practicing for you, Aquila.
Marcus licks a little of the blood off his lip before turning to me.
The slave puts up more of a fight than you do, bastard.
Shut it, Marcus, I say.
Hell, check her. Helene leans down to see if the slave is breathing. It won't be the first time Marcus has killed a slave. I hear her groan.
Elias!
What?
I'm getting angrier by the second, almost hoping Marcus will try something. An old-fashioned fistfight to the death will do me good. From the shadows, Izzy watches us, too frightened to move.
Let him go,
Helene says. I stare at her in shock, but her face is unreadable.
Go,
she says tersely to Marcus, pulling my sword arm down.
Get out of here.
Marcus smiles at Helene, that grating smirk that makes me want to beat the life from him.
You and me, Aquila,
he says as he backs away, eyes smouldering.
I knew you'd start to see it.
Leave, damn it!
Helene hurls a knife at him, missing his ear by inches.
Go!
When the snake disappears out the door, I turn on Helene.
Tell me there was a reason for that.
It's the Commandant's slave. Your friend, Lyra. I see then the cloud of dark hair, the gold skin, which had been obscured by Marcus's body before. A sick feeling fills me as I crouch down beside her and turn her over. Her wrist is broken, the bone jutting out against the skin. Bruises darken her arms and neck. She moans and tries to move. Her hair is a tangled mess, and both of her eyes are blackened and swollen shut.
I'll kill Marcus for this,
I say, my voice flat and calm, a calm I don't feel.
We have to get her to the infirmary.
Slaves are forbidden from seeking treatment in the infirmary,
Izzy whispers from behind us. I'd forgotten she was there.
The Commandant will punish her for it, and you, and the physician.
We'll take her to the Commandant, Helene says. The girl's her property. She has to decide what to do with her.
Cook can help her,
Izzy adds. They're both right, but that doesn't mean I have to like it. I pick Lyra up gently, mindful of her wounds. She is light, and I pull her head to my shoulder.
You'll be fine,
I murmur to her.
All right, you're going to be just fine.
I stride out of the hall, not waiting to see if Helene and Izzy follow. What would have happened if Helene and I hadn't been nearby? Marcus would have raped Lyra, and she'd have bled out whatever life she had left on that cold stone floor. The knowledge fans the rage burning within me. Lyra shifts her head and moans.
Damn him.
To the lowest pit of hell, I mutter. I wonder if she still has the bloodroot I gave her.
This is too much for bloodroot, Elias.
Tunnel,
she says.
Darren, Mas...
Shh, I say. Don't talk now.
All evil here,
she whispers.
Monsters. Little monsters. And then big ones.
We reach the Commandant's house, and Izzy holds open the gate to the servants' corridor. Upon seeing us through the propped kitchen door, Cook drops a bag of spice she's holding, staring at Lyra in horror.
Get the Commandant, I order her. Tell her that her slave is injured.
In here.
Izzy gestures to a low door with a curtain strung across it. I lay Lyra down on the pallet inside with aching slowness, one limb at a time. Helene hands me a threadbare blanket, and I pull it over the girl, knowing how futile it is. A blanket won't help her.
What happened?
The Commandant speaks from behind me. Helene and I duck out into the servants' corridor, now crowded with Izzy, Cook, and the Commandant.
Marcus attacked her,
I say. He nearly killed her.
She shouldn't have been out at this hour. I dismissed her for the evening.
Any injuries she sustained are the result of her own foolhardiness. Leave her. You're on the east wall for watch tonight, as I recall.
Will you send for the physician? Shall I get him? The commandant stares at me as if I'm off my gourd.
Cook will tend to her, she says. If she lives, she lives. If she dies...
My mother shrugs.
Not that it's any business of yours. You slept with the girl, Vittorius. That doesn't mean you own her. Get to watch.
She puts a hand on her whip.
If you're late, I'll take every minute out of your hide. Or,
she tilts her head thoughtfully,
the slaves, if you prefer.
But, Helene grabs me by the arm and pulls me down the corridor. Let go of me!
Didn't you hear her?
Helene says as she hauls me away from the commandant's house and across the sand training fields.
If you're late to watch, she'll whip you. The third trial's 2 days away. How will you survive it if you can't even put on your armor?
I thought you didn't care what happened to me anymore, I say. I thought you were done with me.
What did she mean?
Helene asks quietly.
When she said you'd slept with the girl.
She doesn't know what she's talking about, I say. I'm not like that, Helene. You should know better. Look, I've got to find some way to help Lyra. For 1 second, put aside the fact that you hate me and want me to suffer and die. Can you think of anyone I can take her to? Even someone down in the city?
The commandant won't allow it. She won't know. She'll find out. What's wrong with you? The girl isn't even a marshal, and she has one of her own to help her. That cook's been around for ages. She'll know what to do.
Lyra's words echo in my mind.
All evil here. Monsters. Little monsters. And then big ones.
She's right. What is Marcus if not the worst kind of monster? He beat Lyra with the intent of killing her, and he won't even get punished for it. What is Helene when she so casually shrugs off the idea of helping the girl? And what am I? Lyra's going to die in that dark little room, and I'm doing nothing to stop it.
What can you do?
A pragmatic voice asks.
If you try to help, the commandant will only punish you both, and that will kill the girl for sure.
You can heal her. I realize it suddenly, stunned that I didn't think of it before. The way you healed me.
No.
Helene walks away from me, her entire body suddenly stiff.
Absolutely not.
I chase after her.
You can,
I insist.
Just wait half an hour. The commandant will never know. Get into Lyra's room and...
I won't do it.
Please, Helene.
What's it to you, anyway?
Helene says.
Do you... Are the two of you...
Forget that. Do it for me. I don't want her to die, all right?
Help her. I know you can.
No, you don't. I don't even know if I can. What happened with you after the trial of cunning was bizarre, freakish. I'd never done it before. And it took something out of me. Not my strength, exactly, but... Forget it. I'm not going to try it again. Not ever.
She'll die if you don't.
She's a slave, Elias. Slaves die all the time.
I back away from her.
All evil here. Monsters.
This is wrong, Helene.
Marcus has killed before.
Not just the girl.
This.
I look around.
All of this.
The walls of Blackcliff rise around us like impassive sentinels. There is no sound other than the rhythmic clink of armor as the legionnaires patrolled the ramparts. The silence of the place, its brooding oppression, makes me want to scream. This school, the students that come out of it, the things we do, it's all wrong.
You're tired. You're angry. Elias, you need rest. The trials.
She tries to put her hand on my shoulder, but I shake her off, sick at her touch.
Damn the trials, I say to her. Damn Blackcliff. And damn you too.
Then I turn my back on her and head to watch.
Chapter 35. Liar. Everything hurts. My skin, my bones, my fingernails, even the roots of my hair. My body doesn't feel like my own anymore. I want to scream. All I can manage is a moan. Where am I? What happened to me? Flashes of it come back. The secret entrance, Marcus's fists, then shouts and gentle arms. A clean smell like rain in the desert, and a kind voice. Aspirant Veturius, delivering me from my murderer so I can die on a slave's pallet instead of a stone floor. Voices rise and fall around me. Izzy's anxious murmur and Cook's rasp. I think I hear the cackle of a ghoul. It fades when cool hands coax my mouth open and pour liquid down. For a few minutes, my pain dulls. But it's still near, an enemy pacing impatiently outside the gates. And eventually, it bursts through, burning and reaving. I watched Pop work for years. I know what injuries like this mean. I'm bleeding on the inside. No healer, no matter how skilled, can save me. I'm going to die. The knowledge is more painful than my wounds, for if I die, Darin dies. Izzy remains in Blackcliff forever. Nothing in the Empire changes, just a few more scholars sent to their graves. The shred of my mind that still clings to life rages. Need a tunnel for Mazin. Keenan will be waiting for a report. Need something to tell him. My brother is counting on me. I see him in my mind's eye, huddled in a dark prison cell, his face hollow, his body shaking. Live, liar, I hear him. Live. For me. I can't, Darin. The pain is a beast that's taken over. A sudden chill penetrates my bones, and I hear laughter again. Ghouls. Fight them, liar. Exhaustion sweeps over me. I'm too tired to fight, and at least my family will be together now. Once I die, Darin will eventually join me, and we'll see Mother and Father, Liss, Nan, and Pop. Zara might be there, and later, Izzy. My pain fades as a great, warm tiredness descends. It's so enticing, like I've been working in the sun and have come home to sink into a feather bed, knowing nothing will disturb me. I welcome it. I want it. I'm not going to hurt her. The whisper is hard as glass, and it cuts into my sleep, yanking me back to the world, back to the pain. But I will hurt you if you don't clear out. A familiar voice. The Commandant? No, younger. If either of you say a word about this to anyone, you're dead. I swear it. A second later, cool night air pours into my room, and I drag my eyes open to see Aspirant Aquila silhouetted in the door. Her silver-white hair is pulled back in a messy bun, and instead of armor, she wears black fatigues. Bruises mar the pale skin of her arms. She ducks into the room, her masked face blank, her body betraying a nervous energy. Aspirant Aquila, I choke out. She looks at me as if I smell of rotting cabbage. She doesn't like me. That much is plain. Why is she here? Don't talk. I expect venom, but her voice shakes. She kneels beside my pallet. Just keep quiet and let me think. About what? My ragged breathing is the only sound in the room. Aquila is so silent that it seems as if she's fallen asleep, sitting up. She stares at her palms. Every few minutes, she opens her mouth, as if to speak. Then she clamps it shut again and wrings her hands. A wave of pain washes over me, and I cough. The briny taste of blood fills my mouth, and I spit it out on the floor. In too much pain to care what Aquila thinks. She takes my wrist, her fingers cool against my skin. I flinch, thinking she means me harm. But she just holds my hand, limply, the way you would if you were at the deathbed of a relative you barely knew and liked even less. She starts to hum. At first, nothing happens. She feels out the melody the way a blind man feels his way forward in an unfamiliar room. Her hum crests and falls, explores, repeats. Then something changes, and the hum rises into a song that wraps around me with the sweetness of a mother's arms. My eyes close, and I drift into the strain. My mother's face appears, then my father's. They walk with me at the edge of a great sea, swinging me between them. Above us, the night sky gleams like polished glass, its wealth of stars reflected in the oddly still surface of the water. My toes skim the fine sand below my feet, and I feel as though I'm flying. I understand now. Aquila is singing me into death. She's a mask, after all. And it's a sweet death. If I'd known it was this kind, I'd never have been so afraid. The intensity of the song swells, though Aquila keeps her voice low, as if she doesn't want to be heard. A flash of pure fire burns into me from crown to heel, snatching me from the peace of the seashore. I open my eyes wide, gasping. Death is here, I think. This is the final pain before the end. Aquila strokes my hair, and warmth flows from her fingers into my body, like spiced cider on a freezing morning. My eyes grow heavy, and I close them again as the fire recedes. I return to the beach, and this time Lys races ahead of me, her hair a blue-black banner glowing in the night. I stare at her willow-fine limbs and dark blue eyes, and I've never seen anything so gorgeously alive. You don't know how I've missed you, Lys. She looks back at me, and her mouth moves, one word sung over and over. I can't make it out. Realization comes slowly. I'm seeing Lys. But it's Aquila who's singing. Aquila who is commanding me with just one word repeated in an infinitely complex melody. Live, live, live. Live, 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 live. My parents fade. No! Mother! Father! Lys! I want to go back to them, see them, touch them. I want to walk the night shores, hear their voices, marvel at their closeness. I reach for them, but they're gone. And there's only me, and Aquila, and the stifling walls of my quarters. And that's when I understand that Aquila isn't singing me to a sweet death. She's bringing me back to life.
Chapter 36. Elias. The next morning at breakfast, I sit apart and speak to no one. A chill, dark fog has rolled in off the dunes, settling heavily over the city. It matches the blackness of my mood nicely. I've forgotten about the third trial, about the augurs, about Helene. All I can think of is Lyra, the memory of her bruised face, her broken body. I try to devise some way to help her, bribing the head physician. No, He doesn't have the guts to defy the Commandant. Sneaking a healer in. Who would risk the Commandant's wrath to save a slave's life, even for a fat purse? Does she still live? Maybe her injuries weren't as bad as I thought. Maybe Cook can heal her. Maybe cats can fly, Elias. I'm mashing my food to a pulp when Helene walks into the crowded mess hall. I'm startled at the sloppiness of her hair and the pink shadows beneath her eyes. She spots me and approaches. I stiffen and shove a spoonful of food into my mouth, refusing to look at her.
The slave is feeling better.
She lowers her voice so the students around us can't hear.
I stopped by there. She got through the night.
Is she going to apologize? After refusing to help an innocent girl who hadn't done anything wrong, except be born a scholar instead of a marshal. Better, is she? I say. I'm sure you're thrilled. I get up and walk away. Helene is stone still behind me, as stunned as if I've punched her, and I feel a savage flood of satisfaction. That's right, Aquila. I'm not like you. I'm not going to forget her just because she's a slave. I send a silent thanks to Cook. If Lya survived, it's no doubt due to the older woman's ministrations. Should I visit the girl? What will I say? Sorry Marcus nearly raped and killed you. Heard you're feeling better, though. I can't visit her. She won't want to see me anyway. I'm a mask. If she hates me for that alone, it's reason enough. But maybe I can stop by the house. Cook can tell me how Lya's doing. I can take something for her, something small. Flowers? I look around the school grounds. Blackcliff doesn't have flowers. Maybe I'll give her a dagger. There are plenty of those around, and Skies know she needs one.
Elias!
Helene has followed me out of the mess hall, but the fog helps me evade her. I duck into a training building, watching from a window until she gives up and goes on her way. See how she likes the silent treatment. A few minutes later, I find myself heading to the Commandant's house.
Just a quick visit, just to see if she's all right. Your mother hears about this. She'll skin you alive.
Cook says from the kitchen door when I slip into the servants' corridor.
And the rest of us, too, for letting you in here.
Is she all right?
She's not dead. Go on, aspirant. Leave. I'm not joking about the Commandant.
If a slave spoke like that to Demetrius or Dex, they'd backhand her. But Cook is only doing what she thinks is best for Lya. I do as she asks. The rest of the day is a blur of failed combat battles, curt conversations, and narrow escapes from Helene. The mist gets so thick I can barely see my hand in front of my face, making training more grueling than usual. When the curfew drums beat, all I want is sleep. I head to the barracks, dead on my feet, when Hel catches up to me.
How was training?
She appears out of the mist silently as a wraith, and despite myself, I jump.
Splendid,
I say darkly. Of course it wasn't splendid, and Helene knows it. I haven't fought so poorly in years. What little focus I recovered during last night's battles with Hel is gone.
Faris said you missed sim practice this morning. Said he saw you walking to the Commandant's house.
You and Faris gossip like schoolgirls.
Did you see the girl?
Cook didn't let me in. And the girl has a name. It's Lya.
Elias, it could never work out between you two.
My answering laugh echoes weirdly in the mist.
What kind of idiot do you take me for? Of course it couldn't work. I only wanted to find out if she was all right. So what?
So what?
Helene grabs my arm and yanks me to a halt.
You're an aspirant. You have a trial to take tomorrow. Your life will be on the line, and instead you're mooning over some scholar.
My hackles rise. She senses it and takes a breath.
All I'm saying is that there are more important things to think about. The Emperor will be here in days, and he wants us all dead. The Commandant doesn't seem to know, or care. And I have a bad feeling about the third trial, Elias. We have to hope that Marcus gets eliminated. He can't win, Elias. He can't. If he does...
I know, Helene. I've staked every hope I have on these damned trials. Trust me, I know. 10 hells. I liked her better when she wasn't speaking to me.
If you know, then why are you letting yourself get destroyed in combat? How can you win the trial if you don't have the confidence to defeat someone like Zack? Don't you understand what's at stake?
Of course I do.
But you don't! Look at you! You're too befuddled by that slave girl.
It's not her that's befuddling me, all right? It's a million other things. It's this place and what we do here. It's you.
Me?
She looks bewildered, and that makes me angrier.
What did I do?
You're in love with me! I shout at her now because I'm so angry at her for loving me, even though the logical part of me knows that I'm being cruelly unfair. But I'm not in love with you, and you hate me for it. You've let that ruin our friendship. She just stares, the wound in her eyes raw and growing. Why did she have to fall for me? If she had controlled her emotions, we never would have fought the night of the Moon Festival. We would have spent the last 10 days planning for the third trial, instead of avoiding each other. You're in love with me, I say again. But I could never be in love with you, Helene. Never. You're just like every other mask. You were willing to let Lyra die just because she's a slave.
I didn't let her die.
Helene's voice is quiet.
I went to her last night, and I healed her. That's why she's alive. I sang to her, sang until my voice was gone and I felt like I'd had the life sucked out of me. Sang until she was well again.
You healed her? But...
What? You don't believe I could do something kind for another human? I'm not evil, Elias. No matter what you say.
I never said,
but you did.
Her voice rises.
You just said I'm like every other mask. You just said you could never, never love.
She spins away from me, but after only a few steps, turns back. Trails of mist sweep out behind her like a ghostly dress.
You think I want to feel this way about you? I hate it, Elias. Watching you flirt with illustrian girls and sleep with scholar slaves and find the good in everyone, everyone, but me.
A sob escapes her. The only time I've ever heard her cry. She chokes it back.
Loving you is the worst thing that has ever happened to me. Worse than the Commandant's whippings. Worse than the trials. It's torture, Elias.
She digs a shaking hand into her hair.
You don't know what it's like. You have no idea what I've given up for you. The deal I made.
What do you mean? I say. What deal? With who? For what? She doesn't answer. She's walking, running away from me. Helene! I chase after her, my fingers brushing the wetness of her face for one tantalizing second. Then the mist swallows her up, and she's gone.
Chapter 37 Liar.
Get her up, damn you! The Commandant's orders cut through the fog of my brain, startling me from sleep. I didn't pay 200 marks so she could sleep all day.
My mind is like tar, my body racked with dull pain, but I'm aware enough to know that if I don't rise from this pallet, I really am dead. As I grab a cloak, Izzy pushes the curtain to my room aside.
You're awake!
She's obviously relieved.
Commandant's on the warpath!
What? What day is it? I shiver. It's cold. Far colder than is normal for summer. I have a sudden fear that I've been unconscious for weeks. That the trials are over. That Darren is dead.
Marcus attacked you last night, Izzy says. Aspirant Aquila.
Her eye is wide, and I know then that I didn't dream the aspirant's presence. Or the fact that she healed me. Magic. I find myself smiling at the thought. Darren would laugh, but there's no other explanation. And after all, if ghouls and djinn walk our world, then why not forces of good too? Why not a girl who can heal with a song?
Can you stand? Izzy says. It's past noon. I took care of your morning chores, and I'd do the others, but the Commandant's quite insistent that you...
Past noon? The smile drops from my face.
Skies, Izzy. I had a meeting with the Resistance 2 hours ago. I have to tell them about the tunnel. Keenan might still be waiting.
Liar, the Commandant sealed up the tunnel.
No. No.
That tunnel is the only thing that stands between Darren and death.
She questioned Marcus last night after Veturius brought you in, Izzy says miserably. He must have told her about the tunnel. Because when I went by it this morning, the Legionnaires are bricking it closed.
Did she question you? Izzy nods. And Cook too? Marcus told the Commandant that you and I were spying on him, but I... Well, she fidgets and looks over her shoulder.
I lied.
You lied? For me?
Skies, when the Commandant finds out, she'll kill Izzy.
No, liar, I tell myself. Izzy won't die, because you'll find a way to get her out of here before it comes to that.
What did you say to her? I ask.
Told her that Cook sent us to get Crowley from the storage room by the barracks, and that Marcus waylaid us on the way back.
And she believed you, over a mask?
Izzy shrugs.
I've never lied to her before, she says. And Cook backed up my story, said she was having horrible back pain, and that Crowleaf was the only thing that would help.
Marcus called me a liar, but then the Commandant sent for Zack, and he admitted there was a chance that he'd left the tunnel entrance open, and that we just happened to pass by.
Commandant, let me go after that.
Izzy looks at me worriedly.
Liar, what are you going to tell Mazin?
I shake my head. I have no idea. Cook sends me into the city with a stack of letters for the courier without so much as a mention of the beating I took.
Be quick about it,
the old woman says when I appear in the kitchen to resume my duties.
There's a nasty storm coming, and I need you and kitchen girl to board up the windows before they're blown out.
The city is strangely quiet, its cobbled lanes emptier than usual, its spires shrouded in unseasonable fog. The smells of bread and beast, smoke and steel are dulled, as if the mist has weakened their potency. Conscious of my freshly healed limbs, I move gingerly, but even after a half hour of walking, all that remains of the beating I took are ugly bruises and a dull soreness. I head first to the courier's office in Execution Square, hoping that the resistance is still waiting for me. The rebels don't disappoint. Within seconds of entering the square, I smell cedarwood. Moments later, Keenan materializes out of the fog.
This way.
He says nothing of my injuries, and I'm stung by his lack of concern. Just as I'm willing myself not to care, he takes my hand as if it's the most natural thing in the world, and leads me to the back room of a cramped, abandoned shoe shop. Keenan sets a spark to a lamp hanging on the wall, and as the light flares, He turns and looks me full in the face. The aloofness drops. For a second, he's unveiled, and I know with lightning certainty that behind that coolness he feels something for me. His eyes are almost black as he takes in every bruise. "Who did this?" he asks. "An aspirant. It's why I missed the meeting. I'm sorry."
"Why are you apologizing?"
He is incredulous. "Look at you. Look what they've done to you.
Skies, if your father was alive and knew I let this happen..."
"You didn't let it happen." I put a hand on his arm, surprised at the tautness of his body, like a wolf raring for a fight. "It's no one's fault but the mask who did it. And I'm better now."
"You don't have to be brave, liar."
His words are spoken with a quiet fierceness, and I suddenly feel shy of him. He raises his hand, slowly tracing my eyes, my lips, the curve of my neck with the tip of his finger.
"I've been thinking about you for days."
He puts his warm hand against my face, and I want so much to lean into it.
"Hoping I'd see you in the square, wearing a gray scarf, so this can all be over. So that you can get your brother back. And after, we could... you and I could..."
He trails off. My breath comes in short, shallow bursts, and my skin tingles in wild impatience. He moves closer, drawing up my gaze, pinning me with his eyes. Oh, Skies. He's going to kiss me. Then, bizarrely, he steps away from me. His eyes are guarded again, his face empty of any emotion but a sort of professional detachment. My skin burns in embarrassment at the rejection. A second later, I understand.
"There she is,"
a gruff voice sounds from the door, and Mazin enters the room. I look to Keenan, but he appears almost bored, and I'm shaken at how his eyes can go cold as quickly as a candle being blown out. "He's a fighter," a practical voice chides me. "He knows what's important. As should you. Focus on Darin."
"We missed you this morning, liar."
Mazin takes in my injuries.
"Now I see why. Well, girl, do you have what I want? Do you have an entrance?"
"I have something." The lie takes me by surprise, as does the smoothness with which I tell it. But I need more time. Surprise flashes across Mazin's face for a brief, naked second. Is it my lie that's caught him off guard? My request for more time? Neither, my instinct tells me. Something else. I fidget as I remember what Cook said days ago. "You ask him where exactly your brother is in Central Prison. What cell?" I muster my courage. I have a question for you. You know where Darin is, right? Which prison? Which cell?
Of course I know where he is. If I didn't, I wouldn't be spending all my time and energy figuring out how to free him, now would I?
But, well, Central is so heavily guarded. How will you...
Do you have a way into Blackcliff or not?
Why do you need one? I burst out. He's not answering my questions, and some stubborn part of me wants to shake the answers loose from him. How will a secret entrance to Blackcliff help you free my brother from the most fortified prison in the South? Mazin's gaze hardens from wariness to something close to anger.
Darin's not in Central, he says. Before the Moon Festival, the Marshals moved him to the death cells in Bekhar Prison. Bekhar provides backup guard to Blackcliff. So when we launch a surprise attack on Blackcliff with half of our forces, the soldiers will pour out of Bekhar to Blackcliff, leaving the prison open for our other forces to take.
Oh. I fall silent. Bekhar is a small prison in the Illustrian Quarter, not too far from Blackcliff. But that's all I know about it. Mazin's plan makes sense now. Perfect sense. I feel like an idiot.
I didn't mention anything to you, or anyone else.
He looks pointedly at Keenan.
Because the more people who know about a plan, the more likely it is to be compromised. So, for the last time, do you have
something for me.
There's a tunnel. By time, say anything. But I have to figure out where it lets out.
That's not enough, Mazin says. If you have nothing, then this mission is a failure.
Sir! The door pounds open, and Sunna tumbles in. She looks as if she hasn't slept in days, and she doesn't share the smug smiles of the two men behind her. When she sees me, she does a double take.
Liar! Your face!
Her eyes drop to my scar.
What happened?
Sunna, Mazin barks. Report!
Sunna snaps her attention to the resistance leader.
It's time, she says. If we're going to do it, then we need to leave. Now!
Time for what? I look at Mazin, thinking he'll tell them to wait a moment, that he'll finish with me. But instead, he limps to the door as if I've ceased to exist.
Sunna and Keenan exchange a glance, and Sunna shakes her head as if in warning.
Keenan ignores her. Mazin, he says. What about Liar?
Mazin stops to consider me, the annoyance on his face ill-concealed.
You need more time, he says. You have it. Get me something by midnight, day after tomorrow. Then we'll get your brother out, and this whole thing will be over.
He walks out, engaged in low conversation with his men, snapping at Sunna to follow. The older woman gives Keenan an unreadable look before hurrying out.
I don't understand, I say. A minute ago, he said we were done.
Something's not right.
Keenan stares hard at the door.
And I need to find out what it is.
Will he keep his promise, Keenan? To free Darin?
Sonna's faction's been pushing him. They think he should have broken Darin out already. They won't let him back away from this, but...
He shakes his head.
I have to go. Be safe, Liar.
Outside, the fog is so heavy that I have to put my hands in front of me to keep from running into anything. It's the middle of the afternoon, but the sky grows darker by the second. A thick bank of clouds roils above Sarah, as if gathering strength for an assault. As I head back to Blackcliff, I try to make sense of what just happened. I want to believe that I can trust Mazin, that he'll hold to his end of the bargain. But something is off. I've struggled for days to eke out extra time from him. It makes no sense for him to suddenly give it away so easily. And something else sets my nerves on edge. It's how quickly Mazin forgot about me when Sunna showed up. And it's how, when he promised to save my brother, he didn't quite look me in the eyes.
Chapter 38 Elias. On the morning of the trial of strength, a bone-shaking rumble of thunder jerks me from sleep, and I lay in the darkness of my quarters for a long time, listening to the rain drop the barracks roof. Someone slips a parchment marked with the augur's diamond seal beneath my door. I rip it open. Fatigues only. Battle armor is forbidden. Remain in your room. I will come for you. Cain. A quiet scratching comes at the door as I crumple the note. A terrified-looking slave boy stands outside, offering a tray of lumpy gruel and hard flatbread. I force myself to shovel down every bite. As disgusting as it is, I need all the fuel I can get if I'm going to win in combat. I strap on my weapons, both Teluman Sims across my back, a brace of daggers across my chest, and one knife tucked into each boot. Then I wait. The hours inch by, slower than a graveyard shift on the watchtowers. Outside, the wind rages, sending branches and leaves tumbling past my window. I wonder if Helene is in her room. Has Cain come for her already? Finally, in the late afternoon, a knock comes at my door. I'm so charged I want to rip down the walls with my bare hands. Aspirant Veturius, Cain says when I open the door. It is time. Outside, the cold takes my breath away, cutting through my thin clothes like an icy scythe. It feels as if I'm wearing nothing at all. Sarah is never this cold in the summer. It's hardly ever this cold in the winter. I look sideways at Kane. The weather must be his doing, his and his ilk. The thought darkens my mood. Is there anything they can't do?
Yes, Elias.
Kane answers my question. We cannot die. The hilts of my Sims knock against my neck, cold as ice, and despite the all-weather boots, my feet are numb. I follow Kane closely, unable to make heads or tails of our direction, until the high, arched walls of the amphitheater rise up in front of us. We duck into the amphitheater's armory, which is packed with men in red leather practice armor. I wipe the rain from my eyes and stare in disbelief. Red platoon! Dex and Faris are there, along with the other 27 men in my battle platoon, including Cyril, a barrel-shaped boy who hates taking orders, but accepts mine readily, and Darian, who has fists like hammers. I should find comfort in knowing these men will back me up in the trial, but instead, I'm jumpy. What does Kane have planned for us? Cyril holds out my practice armor.
All present and accounted for, Commander, Dex says.
He looks straight ahead, but his voice betrays his nerves. As I buckle on the armor, I take in the mood of the platoon. Tension radiates off them, but that's understandable. They know the details of the first two trials. They must be wondering what augur-conjured horror they'll have to face.
In a few moments, Kane says, you will exit this armory and find yourself on the amphitheater field. There, you will engage in a battle to the death. Battle armor is forbidden and has already been taken from you. Your goal is simple. You are to kill as many of the enemy as you can. The battle will end when you, Aspirant Veturius, defeat, or are defeated by, the leader of the enemy. I warn you now, if you show mercy, if you hesitate to kill, there will be consequences.
Right. Like having our throats ripped open by whatever is waiting for us out there.
Are you ready?
Kane asks. A battle to the death. That means some of my men, my friends, might die today. Dex meets my eyes briefly. He has the look of a trapped man, a man with a gnawing secret. He flicks a fearful glance at Kane and lowers his gaze. That's when I notice Faris's hands trembling. Beside him, Cyril toys anxiously with a dagger, rubbing its edge against his finger. Darian stares at me strangely. What is that in his eyes? Sadness? Fear? Some dark knowledge haunts my men, something they aren't willing to tell me. Has Kane given them cause to doubt victory? I glare at the augur. Doubt and fear are treacherous emotions before a fight. Together, they can infiltrate the minds of good men and decide a battle before it's begun. I eye the door to the theater's field. Whatever's waiting for us out there, we'll have to be equal to it, or we'll die.
We're ready.
The door opens, and at Kane's nod, I lead the platoon out. The rain is mixed with sleet, and my hands tingle and grow stiff. The bellow of thunder and slap of rain on mud muffles the sound of our passage. The enemy won't hear us coming, but we won't hear them either.
Split!
I shout to Dex, knowing he'll barely be able to make out my words over the storm.
You cover left flank! If you find the enemy, report back to me! Do not engage!
but for the first time since he became my lieutenant, Dex doesn't acknowledge my orders. He doesn't move. He stares over my shoulder into the mist obscuring the battlefield. I follow his gaze, and movement catches my eye. Leather armor, the flash of a sim. Has one of my men slipped ahead for recon? No. I do a quick head count, and they are all arrayed behind me, awaiting orders. Lightning splits the sky, illuminating the battlefield for a tantalizing moment. Then the mist descends, thick as a blanket. But not before I see whom we're fighting. Not before shock turns my blood to ice and my body to stone. I find Dex's eyes. The truth is there, in his pale, haunted gaze, and in Farris's and Cyril's. In every man's. They know. At that moment, a blue-clad figure flies with familiar grace out of the mists, silver braid shining, descending upon Red Platoon like a falling star. Then she sees me and falters, eyes widening.
Elias?
Strength of arms and mind and heart. For this, to kill my best friend, to kill her platoon.
Commander!
Dex grabs me.
Orders!
Helene's men emerge from the mist, sims out and ready. Demetrius, Leander, Tristus, Ennis. I know these men. I grew to adulthood with them, suffered with them, sweated with them. I won't give the order to kill them. Dex shakes me.
Orders, Veturius! We need orders!
Orders. Of course. I'm Red Platoon's commander. It's up to me to decide.
If you show mercy, if you do not kill your enemy, there will be consequences.
Strike to injure only!
I shout. Damn the consequences.
Do not kill! Do not kill!
I barely have time to give the order before Blue Platoon is on us, fighting as viciously as if we're a tribe of border raiders. I hear Helene scream something, but I can't make it out in the cacophony of pounding rain and clashing swords. She disappears, lost in the chaos. I turn to look for her, and spot Tristus cutting through the melee, coming straight for me. He slings a saw-toothed dagger at my chest, and I only just deflect it with my sim. He reaches for his own sim and rushes me. I drop, letting him roll over me before bringing the blunt end of my blade to the back of his legs. He loses his footing and slips into the thickening mud, landing on his back with throat exposed, open for the kill. I turn away, waiting to disarm my next foe. But as I do, Farris, who has gained the upper hand in a fight with another of Helene's men, starts to shake. His eyes bulge. The spear he holds falls from his nerveless fingers, and his face turns blue. His opponent, a quiet boy named Fortis, wipes sleet from his eyes and stares, open-mouthed, as Farris collapses to his knees, clawing at an enemy no one else can see.
What is happening to him?
I rush forward, my mind screaming at me to do something. But as soon as I get within a foot of him, my body is flung back as if by an unseen hand. My vision goes black for a moment, but I scrabble to my feet anyway, hoping none of my foes will choose this moment to attack.
What is this? What's happening to Farris?
Tristus staggers up from where I left him, his face lit with frightening intensity as he finds me. He means to end my life. Farris's chokes fade. He's dying.
Consequences. There will be consequences.
Time shifts. The seconds stretch, each as long as an hour, as I gaze at the mayhem of the battlefield. Red Platoon follows my orders to injure only, and we are suffering for it. Cyril is down. So is Darian. Every time one of my men shows mercy to the enemy, one of their comrades falls. Their life wrung out of them by augur devilry. Consequences. I look between Faris and Tristus. They came to Blackcliff when Helene and I did. Tristus, dark-haired and wide-eyed, covered in bruises from the brutality of initiation. Faris, starved and peaked, no hint of the humor and brawn he'd possess later in life. Helene and I befriended them in our first week, all of us defending each other as best as we could against our predatory classmates. And now one of them will die, no matter what I do. Tristus comes for me, tears streaking his mask. His black hair is covered in mud, and his eyes burn with the panic of a cornered animal as he looks between Faris and me.
I'm sorry, Elias.
He takes a step toward me, and suddenly his body stiffens. The sim in his hand tips into the mud as he peers down at the blade emerging from his chest. Then he slides to the wet ground, his gaze fixed on me. Dex stands behind him, revulsion bursting from his eyes as he watches one of his best friends die by his hand.
No, not Tristus.
Tristus, who's been engaged to his childhood sweetheart since he was 17, who helped me understand Helene, who has four sisters who adore him. I stare at his body, at the tattoo on his arm. Aelia. Tristus, dead.
Dead.
Faris stops struggling. He coughs and stands shakily, then looks down at Tristus's body with dawning shock. But he has as little time to grieve as I do. One of Helene's men sends a mace whistling toward his head, and he is soon locked in another battle, jabbing and lunging as if he hadn't been perched on the edge of the abyss a minute before. Dex is in my face then, his eyes wild.
We have to kill them! Give the order!
My mind won't think the words. My lips won't speak them. I know these men. And Helene. I can't let them kill Helene. I think of the nightmare battlefield, Demetrius and Leander and Ennis. No, no, no. Around me, my men drop, suffocating as they refuse to kill their friends, or falling beneath the merciless blades of Blue Platoon.
Darian's dead, Elias!
Dex shakes me again.
Cyril, too! Aquila gave the order already. You have to give it too, or we're done for. Elias!
He forces me to meet his eyes.
Please!
Unable to speak, I raise my hands and give the signal, my skin crawling as word passes down the battlefield from soldier to soldier. Red Commander's orders. Fight to kill. No quarter. There is no cursing, no yelling, no bluffing. We are, all of us, trapped in a pocket of unending violence. Swords grinding and friends dying and the sleet knifing down on us. I've given the order, and so I take the lead. I show no hesitation, because if I do, my men will falter. And if they falter, we all die. So I kill. Blood taints everything. My armor, my skin, my mask, my hair. The hilt of my sim drips with it, making it slippery beneath my hand. I'm death himself, presiding over this butchery. Some of my victims die with merciful swiftness, gone before their bodies touch the ground. Others take longer. A wretched part of me wants to do it stealthily. Just slip up behind them and slide my sim in so I don't have to see their eyes. But the battle is uglier than that. Harder. Crueler. I stare into the faces of the men I kill. And though the storm muffles the groans, every death carves its way into my memory. Each one a wound that will never heal. Death supplants everything. Friendship, love, loyalty. The good memories I have of these men, of helpless laughter, of bets won and pranks hatched, they are stolen away. All I can remember are the worst things, the darkest things. Ennis, sobbing like a child in Helene's arms when his mother died 6 months back. His neck snaps in my hands like a twig. Leander and his never-to-be-requited love for Helene. My sim slides into his neck like a bird through a clear sky, easily, effortlessly. Demetrius, who screamed in futile rage after he watched his 10-year-old brother whipped to death by the commandant for desertion. He smiles when he sees me coming, drops his weapon, and waits as if the edge of my blade is a gift. What does Demetrius see as the light leaves his eyes? His little brother waiting for him, an infinity of darkness. On goes the slaughter, and all the while, lurking in the back of my head is Cain's ultimatum. The battle will end when you, aspirant Veturius, defeat, or are defeated by, the leader of the enemy. I've tried to seek out Helene and end this quickly, but she's elusive. When she finally finds me, I feel as if I've been battling for days, though in truth it has been no more than half an hour.
Elias!
She shouts my name, but her voice is weak with reluctance. The battle slows to a halt as our men stop attacking each other, as the mist clears enough for them to turn and watch Helene and me. Slowly, they gather around us, forming a half-circle pocked by empty spaces where living men should stand. Hel and I face each other, and I wish for the augur's power to know her mind. Her blonde hair is a tangle of blood, mud, and ice, her braid unpinned and hanging limply down her back. Her chest rises and falls heavily. I wonder how many of my men she's killed. Her fist tightens around the hilt of her sim, a warning she knows I won't miss. Then she attacks. Though I pivot and bring up my sim to parry, my insides are paralyzed. I am staggered at her vehemence. Another part of me understands. She wants this madness done. At first, I try to deflect her, unwilling to go on the offensive. But a decade of ruthlessly honed instinct rebels at such passivity. Soon, I'm fighting in earnest, using every trick I know to survive her onslaught. My mind flickers to the attack poses Grandfather taught me, the ones the Blackcliff Centurions don't know, the ones Helene won't be able to defend against. You can't kill Hel. You can't! But what choice is there? One of us has to kill the other, or the trial won't end. Let her kill you. Let her win. As if she senses my weakness, Helene grits her teeth and drives me back, her pale eyes glacial, daring me to challenge her. Let her, let her, let her! Her sim cuts into my neck, and I counter with a quick thrust just as she's about to take my head off. My battle rage rushes through me, shoving all other thoughts aside. Suddenly, she isn't Helene. She is an enemy who wants me dead, an enemy I must survive. I fling my sim to the sky, watching with mercenary satisfaction as Helene's eyes flick up to follow the weapon's path. Then I strike, coming down on her like an executioner. My knee drives into her chest, and even through the storm, I hear the crack of a rib and the surprised whoosh of her breath leaving her. She is beneath me, her ocean eyes terrified as I pin her sim arm down. Our bodies are entangled, entwined, but Helene is foreign to me suddenly, unknowable as the heavens. I tear a dagger from my chest, and my blood roars as my fingers touch the cold hilt. She knees me and grabs her sim, determined to finish me before I can finish her. I'm too fast. I lift the dagger high, my rage peaking, holding like the highest note of a mountain storm. And then I bring the blade down.
Chapter 39. Liar. In the pre-dawn darkness, the storm churning above Sarah strikes with the wrath of a conquering army. The servants' corridor swims in a half foot of rain, and Cook and I sweep out the water with rush brooms, while Izzy tirelessly stacks sandbags. Rain lashes my face like the icy fingers of a ghost. "Nasty day for a trial," Izzy calls to me over the downpour. I don't know what the third trial will be, and I don't care, except to hope that it serves as a distraction for the rest of the school while I look for a secret entrance into Blackcliff. No one else seems to share my indifference. In Sarah, bets over who will win border on the obscene. The odds, Izzy tells me, have shifted to favor Marcus instead of Veturius. Elias. I whisper his name to myself. I think of his face without the mask and the low, thrilling timbre of his voice when he whispered in my ear at the Moon Festival. I think of how he moved when he fought with Aquila, that sensual beauty that took my breath away. I think of his implacable anger when Marcus nearly killed me. Stop, liar. Stop. He's a mask, and I'm a slave, and thinking of him in this way is so wrong that I wonder for a second if the beating Marcus gave me has muddled my brain. Inside, slave girl. Cook takes my broom, her hair a wild halo in the storm. Commandant's calling. I rush upstairs, soaked through and shivering, to find the Commandant pacing her room with a violent energy, her blonde tresses unbound. My hair, the woman says when I dart into her chambers. Quickly, girl, or I'll have it out of your hide. The second I finish, she leaves the room, snatching her weapons from the wall, not bothering to give me her usual litany of orders. Shot out of here like a wolf on the hunt, Izzy says when I enter the kitchen. Went straight for the amphitheatre. That must be where the trial is. I wonder. You and the rest of the schoolgirl, Cook says. We'll find out soon enough. We're stuck inside today. Commandant said any slave out on the grounds will be killed on sight. Izzy and I exchange a glance. Cook kept us up preparing for the storm until past midnight last night, and I'd been planning to look for a secret entrance today. It's not worth the risk, Lyra, Izzy warns me when Cook turns away. You still have tomorrow. Rest your mind for a day, and a solution might present itself. A rumble of thunder greets her comment. I sigh and nod. I hope she's right. Get to work, you two! Cook shoves a rag in Izzy's hand. Kitchen girl, you finish the silver, polish the banister, scrub the... Izzy rolls her eye and throws down the cloth. Dust the furniture, hang the laundry, I know. Let it wait, Cook. The Commandant's gone for an entire day. Can't we appreciate that, even for a minute? Cook presses her lips together in disapproval, but Izzy assumes a wheedling tone. Tell us a story. Something scary. She shivers in anticipation, and Cook makes a strange sound that could be a laugh or a groan. Life isn't scary enough for you, girl. Quietly, I slip to the back of the kitchen work table to press the seemingly endless stack of the Commandant's uniforms. It's been ages since I've heard a good tale, and I long to get lost in one. But if Cook knows that, she'll probably keep silent on principle. The old woman appears to ignore us. Her hands, small and fine, sift through jars of spices as she prepares lunch. You won't give up, will you? I think at first that Cook is speaking to Izzy, only to look up and find her regarding me. You mean to see this mission to save your brother through to the end, no matter what the cost? I have to. I wait for her to launch into another of her rants against the resistance, but instead, she nods, unsurprised. I have a story for you, then, she says. It has no hero or heroine. It has no happy ending. But it's a story you need to hear. Izzy
raises an eyebrow and takes up her polishing cloth. Cook shuts one spice jar and opens another. Then she begins. "Long ago," she says, "when man knew not greed, malice, tribe, nor clan, jinn walked the earth." Cook's voice is nothing like a tribal Kihani's. It is stern where a tailspinner's would be gentle, all edges where a tailspinner's would be mellow and curved. But the old woman's cadence reminds me of the tribe's people anyway, and I'm pulled into the tale. "Immortal, the Jimwa." Cook's eyes are quiet, as if she's lost in an inner musing. "Created of sinless, smokeless fire. They rode the winds and read the stars, and their beauty was the beauty of the wild places. Though the jinn could manipulate the minds of lesser creatures, they were honorable and occupied themselves with the raising of their young and the protection of their mysteries. Some were fascinated by the untempered race of man. But the leader of the jinn, the king of no name, who was oldest and wisest of them, counseled his people to avoid men. So they did. As centuries passed, men grew strong. They befriended the race of wild elementals, the Afrits. In their innocence, the Afrits showed men the paths to greatness, granting them powers of healing and fighting, of swiftness and fortune-telling. Villages became cities. Cities rose into kingdoms. Kingdoms fell and were melded into empires. From this ever-changing world arose the empire of the scholars, strongest among men, dedicated to their creed, through knowledge, transcendence. And who had more knowledge than the jinn, the oldest creatures of the earth? In an attempt to learn the secrets of the jinn, the scholars sent delegations to negotiate with the king of no name. They received a gentle but firm response. "We are jinn. We are apart." But the scholars hadn't created an empire by giving up at the first rejection. They sent cunning messengers, raised to oration, the way masks are raised to war. When that failed, they sent wise men and artists, spellcasters and politicians, teachers and healers, royalty and commoners. The response was the same. "We are jinn, we are apart." Soon, hard times struck the scholar empire. Famine and plague took whole cities. Scholar ambition turned to bitterness. The scholar emperor grew angry, believing that if only his people had the knowledge of the jinn, they could rise again. He gathered the finest scholar minds into a coven and set them to one task: mastery of the jinn. The coven found dark allies among the fae. Cave afrits, ghouls, wraiths. From these twisted creatures, the scholars learned to trap the jinn with salt and steel and summer rain still warm from the heavens. They tormented the old creatures, seeking the source of their power. But the jinn kept their secrets. Enraged at the evasion of the jinn, the coven no longer cared for fae secrets. They sought now only to destroy the jinn. Afrits, ghouls, and wraiths abandoned the scholars, understanding the full extent of man's thirst for power. Too late. The fae had given their knowledge freely and in trust, and the coven used that knowledge to create a weapon that would conquer the jinn forever. They called it the Star. The fae watched in horror, desperate to stop the doom they helped unleash. But the star gave the humans unnatural power, and so the lesser creatures fled, disappearing into the deep places to wait out the war. The jinn stood fast, but they were too few. The coven cornered them and used the star to lock them forever in a grove of trees, a living, growing prison, the only place powerful enough to bind such creatures. The power unleashed by the jailing destroyed the star and the coven. But the scholars rejoiced, for the jinn were defeated, all but the greatest of them. "The king," Izzy says, Yes, the king of no name escaped imprisonment. But he had failed to save his people, and his failure drove him mad. It was a madness he carried with him like a cloud of ruin. Wherever he went, darkness fell, deeper than a midnight ocean. The king was at long last given a name. The Nightbringer. My head snaps up. My Lord Nightbringer. For hundreds of years, Cook says, the Nightbringer plagued mankind however he could. But it was never enough. Like rats, men scurried into their hiding places when he came, and like rats, they emerged as soon as he was gone. So he began to plan. He allied himself with the scholar's ancient enemy, the Marshals, a cruel people exiled to the northern reaches of the continent. He whispered to them the secrets of steelcraft and statecraft. He taught them to rise above their brutish roots. Then he waited. Within a few generations, the Marshals were ready. They unleashed the invasion. The Scholar Empire fell quickly, its people enslaved, broken, but still alive. And so the Nightbringer's thirst for revenge remains unquenched. He lives now in the shadows, where he lures and enslaves the lesser of his brethren, the ghouls, the wraiths, the cave of Fritz, to punish them for their betrayal so long ago. He watches, he waits, until the time is right, until he can exact his full revenge. As Cook's words die away, I realize I'm holding the press mid-air. Izzy gapes, her polishing forgotten. Lightning flashes outside, and a gust of wind rattles the windows and doors. Why do I need to know this story? I ask. You tell me, girl. I take a deep breath. Because it's true, isn't it? Cook smiles her twisted smile. You've seen the Commandant's nighttime visitor, I take it. Izzy looks between us. What visitor? He called himself the Nightbringer, I say. But it can't be. He's exactly what he says he is, Cook says. Scholars want to close their eyes to the truth. Ghouls, wraiths, wights, djinn. They're just stories. Tribal myths, campfire tales, such arrogance, she sneers. Such pride. Don't you make that mistake, girl. Open your eyes to it, or you'll end up like your mother. Nightbringer was right in front of her, and she never even knew it. I set the press down. What do you mean? Cook speaks quietly, as if she's afraid of her own words. He infiltrated the resistance, she says. Took human form and proposed as a fighter. She clenches her jaw and huffs before going on. Got close to your mother, manipulated and used her. Cook pauses again, her face growing pinched and pale. Your father caught on. The Nightbringer had help. Traitor. Outwitted John and sold your parents to Gerris. No, I... Cook? Izzy jumps up as the old woman grabs her head with one hand and staggers back into the wall with a moan. Cook! Away! The older woman shoves Izzy in the chest, nearly knocking her to the floor. Get away! Izzy raises her hands, her voice pitched low as if she's speaking to a frightened animal. Cook, it's all right. Get to work! Cook draws herself upright, the brief quiet in her eyes shattered, replaced with something close to madness. Leave me be! Izzy pulls me from the kitchen hurriedly. She gets like that sometimes, she says, once we're out of earshot, when she talks about the past. What's her name, Izzy? She's never told me. I don't think she wants to remember it. Do you think it's true, what she said about the Nightbringer, and about your mother? I don't know. Why would the Nightbringer go after my parents? What did they ever do to him? But even as I ask the question, I know the answer. If the Nightbringer hates the scholars as much as Cook says, then it's no wonder he sought to destroy the lioness and her lieutenant. Their movement was the only hope the scholars ever had. Izzy and I returned to our work, each of us silent, our heads filled with thoughts of ghouls and wraiths and smokeless fire. I find that I can't stop wondering about Cook. Who is she? How well did she know my parents? How did a woman who crafted explosives for the resistance end up a slave? Why not just blow the commandant to the 10th ring of hell? Something occurs to me suddenly, something that makes my blood run cold. What if Cook is the traitor? Everyone caught with my parents was killed, everyone who would know anything about the betrayal. And yet Cook's told me things about that time that I've never heard before. How would she know, unless she was there? But why would she be a slave in the commandant's house if she'd handed over Kerris's biggest catch? Perhaps someone in the resistance will know who Cook is, I say that evening as Izzy and I trudged to the commandant's bedroom with buckets and dusters. Perhaps they'll remember her. You should ask your red-haired fighter, Izzy says. He seems like a sharp one. Keenan? Maybe. I knew it, Izzy crows. You like him. I can tell by how you say his name. Keenan, she grins at me, and a blush races up my neck. He's a looker, she comments. Which you've noticed, I take it. Don't have time for that. I've got other things on my mind. Oh, stop, Izzy says. You're human, liar. You're allowed to like a boy. Even masks have crushes. Even I... We both freeze as the front door rattles downstairs. The latch clicks open and wind gusts through the house with a bone-chilling shriek. Slave girl! The commandant's voice cracks up the stairwell. Come here. Go, Izzy shoves me to my feet. Quick! Duster in hand, I hurry down the stairs where the commandant is waiting for me, flanked by two legionnaires. Instead of her usual disgust, her silver face is almost thoughtful as she regards me, as if I've transformed into something unexpectedly fascinating. I notice a fourth figure then, lurking in the shadows behind the legionnaires, his skin and hair as white as bones bleached in the sun. An augur. Well? The commandant throws a wary look at the augur. Is she the one? The augur gazes at me with black eyes that swim in a sea of blood red. Rumor says the augurs can read minds, and the things in my head are enough to take me straight to the gallows for treason. I force myself to think of Pop and Nan and Darren. A great familiar grief fills my senses. Read my mind, then. I meet the augur's gaze. Read the pain your masks have caused me.
She's the one.
The augur doesn't break eye contact, seemingly mesmerized by my anger.
Bring her.
Where are you taking me? The legionnaires bind my hands. What's going on? They've learned about the spying. They must have.
Quiet.
The augur draws up his hood, and we follow him into the storm. When I scream and try to tear free, one of the soldiers gags and blindfolds me. I expect the commandant to accompany us, but instead she slams the door behind me. At least they haven't taken Izzy. She's safe. But for how long? Within seconds, I'm soaked to the skin. I struggle against the legionnaires. But all I succeed in doing is ripping my dress so that it's barely decent. Where are they taking me? The dungeons, liar? Where else? I hear Cook's voice telling the story of the resistance spy who came before me. Commandant caught him, tortured him in the school's dungeon for days. Some nights we could hear him, screaming. What will they do to me? Will they take Izzy too? Tears leak from my eyes. I was supposed to save her. I was supposed to get her out of Blackcliff. After endless minutes of trudging through the storm, we stop. A door opens, and a moment later, I'm airborne. I land hard on a chilly stone floor. I try to stand and scream through the gag, straining at the bonds around my wrists. I try to work off my blindfold so I can at least see where I am. To no avail. The lock clicks, footsteps retreat, and I'm left alone to await my fate.
Chapter 40. Elias. My blade cuts through Helene's leather armor, and part of me screams, "Elias, what have you done? What have you done?" Then the dagger shatters, and while I'm still staring at it in disbelief, a powerful hand grabs my shoulder and pulls me off Helene.
"Aspirant Aquila."
Kane's voice is cold as he flicks open the top of Helene's tunic. Glimmering beneath is the augur-forged shirt Helwan in the Trial of Cunning. Except, like the mask, it's no longer separate from her. It's melded to her, a second sim-proof skin.
"Do you not recall the rules of the trial? Battle armor is forbidden. You are disqualified."
My battle rage fades, leaving me feeling like my insides have been whittled away. I know that this image will haunt me forever. Staring down at Helene's frozen face, the sleet thick around us, the screaming wind that can't drown out the sound of death.
"You nearly killed her, Elias. You nearly killed your best friend."
Helene doesn't speak. She stares at me and puts her hand to her heart, as if she can still feel that dagger coming down.
"She didn't think to remove it."
A voice speaks from behind me. A slight shadow emerges from the mist. A female augur. Other shadows follow, creating a circle around Hel and me.
"She didn't think of it at all,"
the female augur says.
"She's worn it since the day we gave it to her. It's joined with her, like the mask. An honest error, Cain."
"But an error nonetheless. She has forfeited the victory. And even if she had not,
I would have won anyway, because I would have killed her." The sleet slows to a drizzle, and the mist on the battlefield clears, revealing the carnage. The amphitheater is strangely quiet, and I notice then that the stands are filled with students and centurions, generals and politicians. My mother watches from the front row, unreadable as ever. Grandfather stands a few rows behind her, his hand tight on his sim. The faces of my platoon are a blur. Who survived? Who died? Tristus, Demetrius, Leander. Dead. Cyril, Darian, Fortis. Dead. I drop to the ground beside Helene. I say her name.
"I'm sorry I tried to kill you. I'm sorry I gave the order to kill your platoon. I'm sorry. I'm sorry."
The words don't come. Only her name, whispered over and over in the hopes that she will hear, that she will understand. She looks past my face into the roiling sky as if I'm not there.
"Aspirant Veturius," Cain says. "Rise." "Monster, murderer, devil, dark, vile creature. I hate you. I hate you."
Am I speaking to the augur? To myself? I don't know. But I do know that freedom isn't worth this. Nothing is worth this. I should have let Helene kill me. Cain says nothing of the bedlam in my mind. Maybe, in a battlefield choked with the tormented thoughts of broken men, he cannot hear mine.
"Aspirant Veturius," he says, "as Aquila has forfeited, and you, of all aspirants, have the most men left alive, we, the augurs,
name you victor in the trial of strength. Congratulations. Victor.
The word thuds to the ground like a sim falling from a dead hand. 12 men from my platoon survive. The other 18 lie in the back room of the infirmary, cold beneath thin white sheets. Helene's platoon fared worse, with only 10 survivors. Earlier, Marcus and Zack fought each other, but no one seems to know much about that battle. The men of the platoons knew who their enemy would be. Everyone knew what this trial would be. Everyone but the aspirants. Varys tells me this, or maybe Dex. I don't remember how I arrive at the infirmary. The place is chaos. The head physician and his apprentices overwhelmed as they try to save wounded men. They shouldn't bother. The blows we dealt were killing blows. The healers realized the truth soon enough. By the time night falls, the infirmary is quiet, occupied by bodies and ghosts. Most of the survivors have left, half ghosts themselves. Helene is spirited away to a private room. I wait outside her door, throwing black looks at the apprentices trying to get me to leave. I have to speak to her. I have to know if she's all right.
You didn't kill her.
Marcus. I don't draw a weapon at the sound of his voice, though I have a dozen at hand. If Marcus decides to kill me in this moment, I won't lift a finger to stop him. But for once, there's no venom in him. His armor is spattered with blood and mud, like mine. But he seems different. Diminished, like something vital has been torn out of him. No, I say. I didn't kill her.
She was your enemy on the battlefield. It's not a victory until you defeat your enemy. That's what the augurs said. That's what they told me. You were supposed to kill her.
Well, I didn't.
He died so easily.
Marcus's yellow eyes are troubled. His lack of malice so profound that I barely recognize him. I wonder if he actually sees me, or if he just sees a body. Someone alive, someone listening.
The sim. It tore through him,
Marcus says.
I wanted to stop it. I tried, but it was too fast. My name was his first word. Did you know? And his last. Just before the end, he said it. Marcus, he said.
It dawns on me then. I haven't seen Zack among the survivors. I haven't heard anyone speak his name. You killed him, I say softly. You killed your brother.
They said I had to defeat the enemy commander.
Marcus raises his eyes to mine. He seems confused.
Everyone was dying. Our friends. He asked me to end it, to make it stop. He begged me. My brother. My little brother.
Revulsion rises inside me like bile. I've spent years loathing Marcus, thinking of him as nothing more than a snake. Now I can only pity him, though neither of us deserves pity. We are murderers of our own men, of our own blood. I'm no better than he is. I watched and did nothing as Tristus died. I killed Demetrius, Ennis, Leander, and so many others. If Helene hadn't unwittingly broken the rules of the trial, I'd have killed her too. The door to Helene's room opens and I rise, but the physician shakes his head.
No, Vittorius.
He's pale and subdued, all his bluster gone.
She's not ready for visitors. Go, lad. Go get some rest.
I almost laugh. Rest. When I turn back to Marcus, he is gone.
I should find my men, check on them. But I can't face them, and they, I know, won't want to see me. We will never forgive ourselves for what we did today.
I will see Aspirant Veturius, a quarrelsome voice says from the hallway outside the infirmary. That's my grandson, and I damn well want to make sure he's... Elias!
Grandfather shoves past a frightened apprentice as I walk out the infirmary door, pulling me to him, his arms strong around me.
Thought you were dead, my boy, he says into my hair. Aquila's got more spit than I gave her credit for.
I nearly killed her. And the others. I killed them. So many. I didn't want to. I'm going to be sick. I turn from him and retch right there, at the door of the infirmary, not stopping until there's nothing left to get out. Grandfather calls for a glass of water, waiting quietly as I drink it down, his hand never leaving my shoulder. Grandfather, I say. I wish... The dead are dead, my boy, and at your hand. I don't want to hear the words, but I need them, for they are the truth. Anything less would be an insult to the men I killed. No amount of wishing will change it. You'll be trailing ghosts now, like the rest of us. I sigh and look down at my hands. I can't stop them from shaking. I have to go to my quarters. I have to get cleaned up.
I can walk you. That won't be necessary.
Cain appears from the shadows, as welcome as a plague.
Come, aspirant. I would speak to you.
I follow the augur with heavy steps. What do I do? What do I say to a creature who cares nothing for loyalty or friendship or life? I find it hard to believe, I say quietly, that you didn't realize Helene was wearing sim-proof armor.
Of course we realized it. Why do you think we gave it to her? The trials are not always about action. Sometimes they are about intent. You weren't meant to kill Aspirant Aquila. We only wanted to know if you would.
He glances at my hand, which I didn't even realize was itching toward my sim.
I have told you before, Aspirant. We cannot die. Besides, haven't you had enough of death?
Zack. And Marcus. I can barely speak. You made him kill his own brother.
Ah, Zacharias.
Sadness flits across Cain's face, infuriating me further.
Zacharias was different, Elias. Zacharias had to die.
You could have picked anyone, anything for us to fight. I don't look at him. I don't want to retch again. Efrits or whites, barbarians. But you made us fight each other. Why?
We had no choice, Aspirant Veturius.
No choice! A terrible anger consumes me, virulent as a sickness. And though he is right, though I have had enough of death, in this moment all I want is to plunge my sim through Cain's black heart. You created these trials. Of course you had a choice. Cain's eyes flash.
Do not speak of things you do not understand, child. What we do for reasons beyond your comprehension.
You made me kill my friends. I almost killed Helene. And Marcus. He killed his brother. His twin. Because of you.
You'll be doing far worse before this is over.
Worse? How much worse can this get? What will I have to do in the fourth trial? Murder children?
I'm not talking about the trials, Cain says. I'm talking about the war.
I stop mid-stride.
What war?
The one that haunts our dreams.
Cain keeps walking, gesturing for me to follow.
Shadows gather, Elias, and their gathering cannot be stopped. Darkness grows in the heart of the Empire, and it will grow more still until it covers this land. War comes, and it must come, for a great wrong must be righted, a wrong that grows greater with every life destroyed. The war is the only way, and you must be ready. Riddles, always riddles with the augurs.
A wrong, I say through gritted teeth. What wrong? When? How can a war fix it?
One day, Elias Veturius, these mysteries will be made clear. But not this day.
He slows as we enter the barracks. Every door is closed. I hear no curses, no sobs, no snores, nothing. Where are my men?
They sleep, Cain says. For this night they will not dream. Their sleep will not be haunted by the dead. A reward for their valor.
A paltry gesture. They still have tomorrow night to wake up screaming, and all the nights after.
You have not asked about your prize, Cain says, for winning the trial.
I don't want a prize. Not for this.
Nonetheless,
the augur says as we arrive at my room,
you will have it. Your door will be sealed until dawn. No one will disturb you, not even the commandant.
He drifts out of the barracks doors, and I watch him go, wondering uneasily about his talk of war and shadows and darkness. I'm too exhausted to think long on it. My whole body aches. I just want to sleep and forget this ever happened, even if it's just for a few hours. I push the questions out of my head, unlock the door, and enter my quarters.
Chapter 41. Liar. When the door to my cell opens, I bolt toward the sound, determined to escape into the hallway beyond. But the chill in the room has penetrated my bones. My limbs are too heavy, and a hand catches me easily about the waist. Doors sealed by an auger. The hand releases me. You'll hurt yourself. My blindfold is pulled off, and a mask stands before me. I know him instantly. Veturius. His fingers brush my wrists and neck as he unbinds my hands and pulls off my gag. For a second, I'm bewildered. He saved my life all those times so he could interrogate me now. I realize that some naive sliver of me hoped that he was better than this. Not good, necessarily. Just not evil. You knew this, liar, her voice chides me. You knew he was playing a sick game. Veturius kneads his neck awkwardly, and that's when I notice that his leather armor is covered in blood and muck. He has bruises and cuts all over, and his fatigues hang in dull, tattered strips. He looks down at me, and his eyes glint in brief, hot rage before cooling into something else. Shock? Sadness? I won't tell you anything. My voice is high and thin, and I grit my teeth. Be like mother. Don't show fear. I grab my armlet with one hand. I didn't do anything wrong, so you can torture me all you want, but it won't do you any good. Veturius clears his throat.
That's not why you're here.
He is rooted to the stone floor, regarding me as if I am a puzzle. I glare back at him. Why did that red-eyed thing bring me to this cell, if I'm not to be interrogated?
Red-eyed thing, he nods. Good description.
He looks around the chamber, as if seeing it for the first time.
This isn't a cell. It's my room.
I eye the narrow cot, the chair, the cold hearth, the ominous black bureau, the hooks on the wall. For torture, I assumed. It's bigger than my quarters, though just as spare. Why am I in your room? The mask goes to the bureau and rifles through it. I tense. What's in there?
You're a prize, he says. My victory prize for winning the third trial.
A prize, I say. Why would I be... The knowledge sweeps through me suddenly, and I shake my head, as if that will make a difference. I'm keenly aware of the amount of skin showing through my ripped dress, and I try to draw the remnants of cloth together. I take a step back, straight into the chill, rough stone of the wall. It's as far away as I can get, but it won't be far enough. I've seen Veturius fight. He is too fast, too big, too strong.
I'm not going to hurt you.
He turns from the bureau, looking at me with an odd sympathy in his eyes.
That's not how I am.
He holds out a clean, black cloak.
Take this. It's freezing.
I eye the cloak. I'm so cold. I've been cold since the Augur threw me in here hours ago. But I can't take what Veturius offers. There's a trick in this. There must be. Why would I have been chosen as his prize, if not for that? After a moment, he sets the cloak on the cot. I can smell the rain on him and something darker. Death. Silently, he starts a fire in the hearth. His hands tremble. You're shaking, I observe.
I'm cold.
The wood catches, and he feeds the fire patiently, absorbed in the task. There are two Sims strapped to his back, only a few feet away. I can grab one if I'm fast enough. Do it, now, while he's distracted. I lean forward, but just as I'm about to lunge, he turns. I freeze, teetering, ridiculously.
Take this instead.
Veturius takes a dagger from his boot and tosses it to me before turning back to the flames.
It's clean, at least.
The dagger's warm heft is comforting in my hand, and I test the edge on my thumb. Sharp. I sink back against the wall and eye him warily. The fire eats away at the cold in the room. When it is burning brightly, Veturius unstraps his Sims and leans them against the wall, well within my reach.
I'll be in there.
He nods to a closed door in the corner of the room, one I'd assumed led to a torture chamber.
That cloak won't bite, you know. You're stuck here until dawn. Might as well make yourself comfortable.
He opens the door and disappears into the bathing chamber beyond. A moment later, I hear water pour into a tub. The silk of my dress steams in the heat of the fire, and with one eye on the bath door, I let its warmth seep into me. Then I consider Veturius's cloak. My skirt is ripped to my thigh, and a sleeve of my shirt hangs by a few threads. The laces of my bodice are torn, revealing far too much of me. I look uneasily toward the bath. He'll finish soon. Eventually, I pick up the cloak and wrap it around myself. It is made of thick, finely woven cloth that is softer to the touch than I expect. I recognize the smell. His smell. Spice and rain. I inhale deeply before jerking my nose away as the door rattles and Veturius emerges with his bloodied armor and weapons. He scrubbed the mud from his skin and changed into clean fatigues.
You'll get tired standing all night, he says. You can sit on the bed, or take the chair.
When I don't move, he sighs.
You don't trust me. I get it, but if I wanted to hurt you, I'd already have done it.
Please, sit down. I'm keeping the knife.
You can have a Sim, too. I have a pile of weapons I never want to see again. Take them all.
He drops into the chair and begins cleaning his greaves. I sit stiffly on his bed, ready to bring up the knife if I have to. He is close enough to touch. He says nothing for a long time, his movements heavy and tired. Beneath the shadow of his mask, his full mouth seems harsh, his jaw unyielding. But I remember his face from the festival. It's a handsome face, and even the mask can't hide that. His diamond-shaped black cliff tattoo is a dark shadow on the back of his neck, parts of it tinged silver, where the metal of his mask cleaves to his skin. He looks up, sensing my gaze, and then glances quickly away, but not before I see telltale redness in his eyes. I loosen my white-knuckled grip on the knife. What could upset a mask, an aspirant, enough to bring him to tears?
"What you told me about living in the scholar's quarter," he says, breaking the quiet of the room, "with your grandparents and your brother. That was true once.
Until a few weeks ago, the Empire raided us. A mask came, killed my grandparents, took my brother.
And your parents?
Dead. A long time ago now. My brother's the only one left. But he's in the death cells in Bekkar prison." Futurius glances up at me.
"Bekkar doesn't have death cells."
His comment is offhand and so unexpected that it takes a moment to sink in. He looks back down at his work, blind to the impact his words have had on me.
"Who told you he was in a death cell? And who told you he was in Bekkar?"
"I heard a rumor."
"Idiot, liar. You walked into this."
"From a friend."
"Your friend's wrong, or confused. Sarah's only death cells are in Central. Bekkar's much smaller and usually filled with swindling Mercators and plebeian drunks. It's no cough, that's for sure. I would know. I've done guard duty at both."
"But if Blackcliff, say, got attacked..." My mind races as I think of what Mazin told me. "Isn't it Bekkar that provides your security?" Futurius chuckles without smiling. "Bekkar protecting Blackcliff.
Don't let my mother hear. Blackcliff has 3,000 students bred for war, liar. Some are young, but unless they're green, they're dangerous. The school doesn't need backup, least of all from a pack of bored oxes who spend their days taking bribes and racing roaches."
"But I have misheard Mazin."
"No. He said Darin was in the death cells in Bekkar, and that the prison provided Blackcliff's security backup, all of which Futurius has just refuted. Is Mazin's information bad, or is he lying to me?
Once, I'd have given him the benefit of the doubt, but Cook's suspicions, and Keenan's, and my own weigh heavy on me. Why would Mazin lie? Where is Darin, really? Is he even alive?"
"He is alive. He must be. I'd know if my brother was dead. I'd feel it." "I've upset you," Futurius says. "I'm sorry, but if your brother's in Bekkar, he'll be out soon. No one stays in there more than a few weeks."
"Of course." I clear my throat and try to wipe the confusion from my face. Masks can smell a lie. They can sense deceit. I have to act as normal as I can. "It was just a rumor." He gives me a swift look, and I hold my breath, thinking he is about to question me further. But he just nods and raises his leather greaves, now clean, to the firelight before hanging them from the hooks embedded into the wall. So that's what those hooks are for. Is it possible Futurius won't hurt me? He's pulled me from death so many times. Why do that if he wishes violence upon me?
"Why did you help me?"
I blurt out. "Down in the dunes after the Commandant marked me, and at the Moon Festival, and when Marcus attacked me, every time you could have turned away. Why didn't you? He looks up, thoughtful. The first time, I felt bad. I let Marcus hurt you the day I met you, outside the Commandant's office. I wanted to make up for it. I make a small noise of surprise. I didn't even think he noticed me that day. And then, later, at the Moon Festival, and with Marcus, he shrugs. My mother would have killed you. Marcus, too. I couldn't just let you die. Plenty of masks have stood and watched as scholars died. You didn't. I don't enjoy others' pain, he says. Maybe that's why I've always hated Blackcliff. I was going to desert, you know. His smile is sharp as a sim and as joyless. I had it all planned out. I dug a path from that half. He points. To the entrance of the West Branch Tunnel, the only secret entrance in the whole of Blackcliff. Then I mapped my way out of here. I was going to use tunnels the Empire thinks are caved in or flooded. I stole food, clothing, supplies. I drained my inheritance so I could buy what I needed on the way. I planned to escape through the tribal lands and take a ship south from Sard. I was going to be free, from the Commandant, Blackcliff, the Empire. So stupid, as if I could ever be free of this place. I almost stop breathing as his words sink in. The only secret entrance in the whole of Blackcliff. Elias Veturius has just given me Darin's freedom. That is, if Mazin is telling the truth. I'm not so sure anymore. I want to laugh at the absurdity of it. Veturius giving me the key to my brother's freedom, just as I realize that such information might not mean anything. I've been silent too long. Say something. I thought being chosen for Blackcliff was an honor. Not for me, he says. Coming to Blackcliff wasn't a choice. The augurs brought me here when I was 6. He picks up his sim and slowly wipes it clean. I recognize the intricate etchings on it. It's a Talamon blade. I lived with the tribes back then. I'd never met my mother. I'd never even heard the name Veturius. But how? Veturius? As a child? I've never considered it. I've never wondered if he knew his father, or if the Commandant raised him and loved him. I've never wondered, because he's never been anything more than a mask. I'm bastard born, Veturius says. The only mistake Caris Veturia has ever made. She bore me, and then exposed me in the tribal desert. It's where she was stationed. That would have been the end of me. But a tribal scouting party happened along. Tribesmen think baby boys are good luck, even abandoned ones. Tribe Scythe adopted me, raised me as one of their own, taught me their language and stories, dressed me in their clothes. They even gave me my name, Ilias. My grandfather changed it when I came to Blackcliff, turned it into something more appropriate for a son of Jens Veturia. The tension between Veturius and his mother is suddenly clear. The woman never even wanted him. Her ruthlessness astounds me. I'd helped Pop bring dozens of newborns into the world. What kind of person could leave something so small, so precious, to die of heat and starvation? The same person who could carve a K into a girl for opening a letter. The same person who would dash out a 5-year-old's eye with a poker. What do you remember from that time? I ask. From when you were a child? From before Blackcliff? Veturius frowns and puts a hand to his temple. The mask shimmers strangely at his touch, like a pool rippling beneath a drop of rain. I remember everything. The caravan was like a small city. Tribe Scythe is dozens of families strong. I was fostered by the tribe's Kihani, Mamie Rila. He speaks for a long time, and his words weave a life before my eyes, the life of a dark-haired, curious-eyed child who snuck out from lessons so he could go adventuring, who waited eagerly at the edge of camp for the men of the tribe to return from their merchant forays. A boy who scrapped with his foster brother one minute and laughed with him the next. A child without fear, until the augurs came for him and plunged him into a world ruled by it. But for the augurs, it could be Darin he is speaking of. It could be me. When he falls silent, it's as if a warm gold haze has been lifted from the room. He has a Kihani's skill at storytelling. I look up at him, surprised to see not the boy, but the man he has become. Mask. Aspirant. Enemy.
I've bored you, he says.
No, not at all. You were like me. You were a child. A normal child. And that was taken from you.
Does that bother you?
Well, it certainly makes you harder to hate.
Seeing the enemy as a human, a general's ultimate nightmare.
The augurs brought you to Blackcliff. How did it happen? This time, his pause is longer, heavy with the taint of a memory better forgotten.
It was autumn. The augurs always bring a new crop of yearlings in when the desert winds are at their worst. The night they came to the Scythe encampment, the tribe was happy. Our chief had just returned from a successful trade, and we had new clothes and shoes, even books. The cook slaughtered 2 goats and spit-roasted them. The drums beat. The girls sang, and stories poured from Mamie Reeler for hours. We celebrated into the night, but finally everyone slept. Everyone but me. I'd had this strange sense for hours that some darkness was closing in. I saw shadows outside the wagon, shadows circling the camp. I looked out of the wagon where I was sleeping and saw this man. Black clothing and red eyes and skin without any color at all. An augur. He said my name. I remember thinking he must be part reptile, because his voice came out of him like a hiss. And that was it. I was chained to the Empire. I was chosen.
Were you afraid?
Terrified. I knew he was there to take me away, and I didn't know where or why. They brought me to Blackcliff, cut off my hair, took my clothes, and put me in a pen outside with the others for a culling. Soldiers threw us moldy bread and jerky once a day. But back then I wasn't very big, so I never got much. Midway through the 3rd day, I was sure I would die. So I snuck out of the pen and stole food from the guards. I shared it with my lookout. Well, he looks up, considering. I say share, but really, she ate most of it. Anyway, after 7 days, the augurs opened the pen, and those of us still alive were told that if we fought hard, we would be the guardians of the Empire, and if we didn't, we'd be dead.
I can see it. The small bodies of those left behind, the fear in the eyes of those who lived. Vaturius as a boy, afraid and starved, determined not to die. You survived.
I wish I hadn't. If you'd seen the 3rd trial, if you knew what I did.
He polishes the same spot on one of the sims over and over. What happened? I ask softly. He is silent for so long that I think I've angered him, that I've crossed a line. Then he tells me. He pauses frequently, and his voice goes from broken to flat. He keeps working on the sim, shining it, then sharpening it with a whetstone until it gleams.
When he is done speaking, he hangs the sim up. The streaks running down his mask catch the firelight, and I understand now why he was shaking when he walked in, why his eyes are so haunted. "So you see," he says, "I'm just like the mask who killed your grandparents. I'm just like Marcus. Worse, actually. Because such men consider it their duty to kill. I know better. And I did it anyway." "The augurs didn't give you a choice. You couldn't find Aquila to end the trial. And if you hadn't fought, you'd have died." "Then I should have died." "Nan always said that as long as there is life, there is hope. If you'd refused to give the order, your men would be dead right now, either at the hands of the augurs or on the blades of Aquila's platoon. Don't forget, she chose life for herself and her men. Either way, you'd have blamed yourself. Either way, people you cared about would have suffered."
"Doesn't matter."
"But it does matter. Of course it matters. Because you're not evil. The knowledge is a revelation, and one so staggering that I badly want him to see it too. You're not like the others. You killed to save. You put others first. Not like me." I can't bring myself to look at Veturius. "When the mask came, I ran. The words spill out of me. A tumbling river I've dammed up for too long. My grandparents were dead. The mask had Darin, my brother. Darin told me to run, even though he needed me. I should have helped him, but I couldn't. No." I dig my fists into my thighs. "I didn't. I chose not to stay. I chose to run like a coward. I still don't understand it. I should have stayed, even if that meant dying." My eyes seek the floor in shame, but then his hand is on my chin, tipping my face up. His clean scent washes over me.
"As you say, Lyra," he forces me to meet his eyes. "There's hope in life. If you hadn't run, you'd be dead. And Darin, too."
He lets me go and sits back.
"Masks don't like defiance. He'd have made you pay for it."
"Doesn't matter." Veturius smiles that knife's edge smile.
"Look at us," he says. "Scholar, slave, and mask, each trying to persuade the other that they're not evil. The augurs do have a sense of humor, don't they?"
My fingers are clenched around the hilt of the dagger Veturius gave me, and a hot anger rises inside me. At the augurs for letting me think I was to be interrogated. At the commandant for leaving her own child to die a torturous death. And at Blackcliff for training that child to be a killer. And my parents for dying, and my brother for apprenticing himself to a marshal. At Mazin for his demands and secrets. At the Empire and its iron-fisted control over every aspect of our lives. I want to defy all of them. The Empire, the Commandant, the Resistance. I wonder where such defiance comes from, and my armlet feels hot suddenly.